Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin and look at the real state of unemployment in the country and its likely political consequences. We'll be joined by Michael Lynn, the Whitehead Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. He's the author of a number of books, including Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and What Lincoln Believed, and The American Way of Strategy, U.S. Foreign Policy and the American Way of Life. And he has an article now in Salon.com. That sound you hear is the social fabric beginning to snap. And this, in this article, he talks about the severe consequences of unemployment in America, a rate which he and many economists say is actually 20%. And then we'll look at how the United States, Russian, and French leaders discussed Iran's nuclear future on the phone this week. At the same time, there were more defiance from the Speaker of Iran's parliament. And we'll look into the possible deal to ship Iran's enriched uranium to Russia and the extent to which that might forestall a possible Israeli strike. We'll be joined by Jahan Salehi, who was born in Iran, raised and educated in the United States, and he's formerly the managing director of the European operations of the Los Angeles Times Syndicate and currently the international director of Agence Globale, or Global, Agence Global. Sorry about my French there, and international media agency, which has correspondent specialists and analysts covering regions all over the world, including Iran. And we'll be talking to him. And then after that, we'll talk with Dan Walters, who's a political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. He covers the state capital. He's been covering it since 1975. The co-author of a new book entitled The Third House, Lobbyists, Money, and Power in Sacramento. So I'll be looking into California's state of dysfunction. I'm now speaking with Michael Lind, who is the Whitehead Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. He has an article in Salon.com, That Sound You Hear is a Social Fabric Beginning to Snap. And you, along with a number of economists, say that the figure that the official figure of 9.8% unemployment basically doesn't include the 835,000 Americans who've given up looking for work, even though they want work. Essentially, you're suggesting that the real figure is perhaps as high as 20?
That's absolutely right, Ian. If you count people who have given up looking for work or underemployed or working part-time but want full-time jobs, then that raises the number to 17%. If you then include people who have not looked for work in over a year because they're so discouraged, it gets up to about 18.8%, nearly 20%. That means, by an accurate estimate, nearly one out of five Americans is either unemployed or underemployed. And that's a tremendous social crisis.
And why we appear to living in a kind of a fool's paradise here, because there's no real mention of this in the press, and there's no sense of anxiety, alarm, and also there's no manifestation that you had during the Great Depression. With that, of course, we had more people out of work in those days, but even these figures are creeping in that direction.
Well, ironically, the relative invisibility of the unemployed is a testimony to the success of the reforms this country undertook after the Great Depression. During the New Deal, we installed an unemployment system so that people are receiving unemployment insurance. The federal government, as part of the stimulus package, has increased aid to the states to keep unemployment funds going. So in a way, you know, that's good for the individual, but in a way it's bad for the political system, because it means that you don't see, you know, the hordes of people begging on the streets and riding the rails as hobos that you saw during the Great Depression. And so by removing the visible evidence of this crisis, which is a good thing for the individuals involved, we've greatly reduced the political salience of it. And so we're focused on things other than the number one crisis facing the country, which is unemployment.
So what will it take then for the pain and angst out there to translate itself into political power? If it's made invisible, does that mean it's politically powerless?
Well, Well, I think that's part of it. Part of it is simple confusion. We don't know what the so-called new normal with respect to employment or anything else in the economy will look like following this crisis. What you see in this crisis is basically three events happening simultaneously. One is an ordinary cyclical recession. The second, which is bigger, is the popping of a bubble, or rather two bubbles in a row, the tech bubble and the housing bubble. And the third is a long-term transition, which was well underway even in the 90s, from one kind of service economy based on office work and clerical work to another kind of service economy based on personal services. So all three of these are happening simultaneously, and it's very baffling. I personally am not a prophet. I can't tell you exactly what the result will be. But right now, the political establishment, I think, is unrealistically optimistic. You know, they're sort of treating this as though it were a recession or maybe the bursting of a bubble, and then we can get back in a couple of years to something like an unreformed system. My intuition is the crisis will last much longer than most people hope, and the America that results will be quite different in many ways.
So you're suggesting perhaps that there will be an accepted and permanent level of unemployment?
That's quite possible, that the level of unemployment that we've had in the last couple of decades was artificially low because of these unnatural asset bubbles created the illusion of wealth and a lot of consumer spending that was based on debt finance and borrowing rather than on actual wage increases. And so now that we've eliminated those, and we have to hope, however painful it is, that we don't have a third bubble, you know, because that would simply postpone the day of reckoning. But since the bubble wealth is gone, the debt-fueled consumption is gone, that means we may have to rebuild our way out of this hole. And this can take years, even decades, of very slow growth and fairly high unemployment. And like all painful things, this is something official Washington prefers not to think about. But it's something that I think that the citizens of the country have to think about and force our elected representatives to deal with directly.
And Michael Lind, how does this all connect, which it surely must, with what's just happened on Wall Street, where you have a kind of there's a separate universe there between Wall Street and Main Street. And essentially, Wall Street went crazy, created its own casino, created its own chips, leveraged itself to the stratosphere. And then when the whole thing crashed, they then turned to the taxpayer, who's basically left holding these toxic assets. And now Wall Street is posting all kinds of profits, and they're bullish again, and the Dow's at 10,000. Meanwhile, Main Street is languishing. It feels to me, and I, you know, there was that study from Citigroup of the internal memo suggesting that we have a plutonomy, that you've got the plutonomy over there, and then you've got sort of Main Street languishing over here, and these kind of shovel-ready jobs out on the freeways and highways. You just have to travel through the country. You can see that, old-fashioned stimulus money. But how are you going to reconcile these two separate universes?
Well, I think you've put your finger on it. This kind of bear market rally where Wall Street is doing very well in the midst of an otherwise devastating crisis shows that there's a disconnect now between the financial system and the real economy. And you described the real economy as Main Street, but I would also include a lot of manufacturing businesses, even a lot of global corporations that actually do things, whether it's pharmaceuticals or automobiles or aerospace. They're part of the real productive economy. And so it's not so much a matter of the workers versus the employers as a particular business sector, the financial sector, versus the rest of the economy, including other business sectors and other industries. It's clear what happened. We've seen the evolution of what I call financial market capitalism in the last 20 or 30 years. We had managerial capitalism in the U.S. and similar countries in Europe and Asia up until about the 70s and 80s. The banks were subordinate to industry. They had gotten out of control in the 19-teens and 20s, but after World War II, they were reined in the U.S. and in similar countries, and banks were basically highly regulated public utilities. Their purpose was to supply credit to consumers and capital to real economy industries, to manufacturing and agriculture and the actual productive economy. Since then, they've in the United States, as well as in Britain, and to some degree in Europe and Japan, they've essentially collaborated with politicians to tear down the regulations. And so what were utilities have become casinos. They make much of their money by gambling on exchange rates, you know, on highly complicated securitized products, asset derivatives, and so on. And
commodities, you know, like oil.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, on a small scale, that kind of speculation is not necessarily a problem. But when most banks are bored, I mean, frankly, they're bored with, you know, the purposes for which banks are chartered, which is, you know, as intermediaries between depositors and consumers and businesses. They couldn't make enough money doing that compared to placing these large bets. And so they're bored with it. And I think it's time for the public and their elected representatives to say, look, we don't charter banks so that you can place bets in a Las Vegas-type casino. We charter you, you know, to take deposits without ripping people off with fees, you know, not to be predatory in your lending practices. And on the other side of the intermediation coin, you're supposed to be supplying consumers and credit-worthy businesses with credit, and you're not doing that. So what exactly are you? You know, you're not really banks anymore in the classic definition.
Well, but they're also in the business of extracting wealth, not creating wealth. And I wonder, in terms of American capitalism, how long can that survive?
Well, fortunately, in a way, we live in a world with multiple power centers. And if the United States, and also Britain, which has gone down this path, you know, essentially allow their cancerous financial sector to prey upon their crumbling industrial sector, then other countries in Asia and Europe, sooner or later, you know, somebody's going to reject that model. And the model that result may not be anything particularly sympathetic to us, but it will force us at some point to adapt, because in the real world, what I'm calling the real economy, that is the ability to have efficient manufacturing and agriculture and energy and communications and transportation, that's all that counts in the long run. And if the money that should go into productive investments in that area, be they public investments or private investments, instead is being siphoned off into bankers' bonuses and into gambling, then the country that allows that sort of thing is going to fall behind other countries that forbid it.
Well, Michael Lind, it seems, though, that Wall Street owns Washington, that they've got a lock on the politicians, and that they've bought them all. And efforts now in the wake of this sector, this financial sector, taking the global economy to the brink of collapse, by all reviews in Sunday's New York Times editorial, they go through the state of financial reform, and there, you know, it's not really reform. Too little regulation on derivatives, some protection for consumers, but the banking lobby is furiously trying to kill anything that with any teeth. So, if our Congress is already in the pocket of Wall Street, how do you get them out of the pocket of Wall Street? And, I mean, can the very sector that you're talking about, the manufacturing, agriculture, transportation, and communication sector, can they bribe them back? I mean,
you know, it's a sad day when it's sort of a bidding war between different industry lobbyists. But let me add that the problem is with the White House, too. This administration has frozen out Paul Volcker, one of its supposed advisors, who, like a lot of people from the left to the right, this is not a partisan thing. You have people on the left like Robert Reich, and you have people on the right like Martin Wolf and Paul Volcker, who think we should go back to something like the Glass-Steagall regime we had after the New Deal, where you separated what I'm calling utility banking from the casino operations, you know, from investment banking and more speculative activities. The administration has said no to this and submitted to Congress a very toothless kind of cosmetic reform package that would essentially Wall Street loves, and it's only going to get watered down further as it goes through Congress. Yeah, there's a serious problem, I think, of political capture of both parties by finance, because the finance sector swelled to 40% of corporate profits by 2007. And a lot of those corporate profits went into Republican and Democratic campaign donations. A lot of them went to the Obama campaign. Remember, Barack Obama is president of the United States in part because he got more Wall Street donations than Hillary Clinton and John Edwards. He appointed the most Wall Street-friendly group of economic advisors, beginning with Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, of any Democratic president in history. So I think it's kind of naive, you know, to expect the Democrats, who have become the Wall Street Party in recent years, even more than the Republicans, you know, to lead the charge for reform. Now, you would think the Republicans would pick up the gauntlet of anti-Wall Street reform. And you have a few populists like Mike Huckabee, you know, who have talked about it. But the Club for Growth, which is a Republican lobbying group, funnels campaign donations to support pro-Wall Street Republican candidates. So I think it's a serious crisis. And it goes beyond ordinary interest group politics, because if you have lots of little interest groups, they can kind of neutralize each other. But here you have a giant, swollen, Simon Johnson, a former World Bank official, calls it the oligarchy. And that is a serious threat to the functioning and the future of democracy in this country, in my opinion.
Well, but it sounds to me that people ought to start accepting what Simon Johnson's saying, that why delude ourselves that we are a democracy if indeed we are a plutocracy or we have a predatory oligarchy that's extracting money. I mean, the poster boy who just got taken care of this week could be Andrew J. Hall, who was an energy speculator who was gaming the gasoline market for Citicorp, heading up their group that was gaming the price, and they helped contribute to the run-up in oil to $147 a barrel, along with J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs. He's $100 million payoff has been held up by the Paysar. And then, so Citigroup then sold that division to Occidental, and they're going to take care of Andrew J. Hall and pay him his $100 million. But his $100 million is his contribution to society is he made gasoline more expensive for the American consumer.
Exactly.
And he gets a payoff of $100 million. So you can extrapolate what the profit must have been for Citicorp. Billions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I don't have any near-term easy solution. Increasingly, I think that campaign finance reform has to be part of the solution. But it's in a paradoxical way. The parties should be able to raise more money and spend more money on candidates than less. Right now, we have this kind of perverse political finance system where the parties are limited in how much money they can spend on individual House races and Senate races, right? That's called soft money, and it's supposed to be bad. But the problem with that is because if you're running for Congress, you're running for the Senate, you can't get that much money from the Democratic Party nationally or the National Republican Party. You have to raise money from special interests, of which the biggest and most powerful of all now is the financial sector. So that if the parties were able to pool vast amounts of money so big that any single sector could not control it, they would be able to say no. At least that's the theory, which I think is plausible. They could say no to particular industries. Now, obviously, you know, some industries would be harder to say no to than others. And they could say, you know, that would allow members of Congress to run against Wall Street from particular districts with the party money backing them, even if Wall Street wanted to target those particular candidates in primaries. Because right now, the way industries, not just Wall Street, but telecom and other industries, it's not that they bribe the politicians. It's not that they put the money in the politician's personal bank account. They intimidate the politicians. They say, if you vote against us on this measure, we will pour money onto your opponent, usually in your own party primary, because most that's the other part of this problem. We don't have a two-party system in the United States. We have two regional one-party systems. And so the real election in most of the country is the party primary. It's the Democratic Party primary, the Republican Party primary.
Right. Well, that's an old tactic. Apex used it for years. You know, if you don't do what we tell you to do, if you're a left-wing Democrat, we'll run a guy in the primary who's further to the left of you. And if you're a right-wing Republican, we'll recruit somebody that's further to the right of you.
But that's why I think we ought to allow the national parties, you know, to be able to spend whatever it takes against special interests in some of these elections. Because remember, there are very few actual contested elections in this country.
No, it's worse than that.
Beyond a reform like that, I don't know how you get past this problem.
Well, just in closing, Michael Lynn, what impact is this going to have on the 2010 elections? I did a piece a few weeks ago with Nate Silver, who's predicting, you know, he got the last election right. He's predicting a loss, I think, between 10 and 20 or 30 seats, I can't remember now, in the House. Is that just inexorable, that as this 20% unemployment looms out there and will probably get worse, it's just there's nothing the Democrats can do but suffer losses?
Yeah, well, they're going to suffer losses. That's been the usual pattern in midterm elections. The president's party loses some seats in Congress, and there have been a few exceptions to that, like 2004, but for the most part, that's been the norm. I don't think that's necessarily good news for the Republicans, though, because the Republicans, apart from the Tea Party movement, which has kind of fizzled, they haven't really been able to tap into populist anger. What I think is going to happen is, if the Democrats continue to play nice with Wall Street, and if the Republicans aren't able to mobilize some kind of alternative, you're going to see some kind of Ross Perot or, you know, Ralph Nader, you know, Lou Dobbs, who knows. But I think we're more and more likely to see some kind of independent challenger in 2012 that could make the presidential race interesting. That's just I said I'm not a prophet, but that's my prophecy.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking with Michael Lind, who's a Whitehead Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, and he has an article in Salon.com, "That Sound You Hear Is the Social Fabric Beginning to Snap." I'm now speaking with Jahan Salehi, who was born in Iran, raised and educated in the United States, formerly was the Managing Director of European Operations for the Los Angeles Times Syndicate, and he's currently International Director of Agence Global, which is an international media agency with correspondent specialists and analysts covering regions of the world, including Iran. And this week, Jahan, the U.S. president, the Russian president, the French leader Sarkozy, they all discussed Iran's nuclear future on the phone, but at the same time, there was more defiance from the Speaker of Iran's parliament. So what do you think is the chances of this possible deal of shipping Iran's enriched uranium to Russia for further enrichment for nuclear fuel and for research reactors as well? What's the chance of this thing happening?
Well, again, unlike your previous guest, as you know, over the last few years when I've had the pleasure of being on your show, I'm happy to be a prophet. And the prediction I have is that by year's end, there'll be a deal that's very similar to the deal currently on the table, where Iran is going to ship the bulk of its low-enriched uranium, the LEU, we'll call it, right? The low-enriched uranium, they'll ship it to Russia. It'll be, you know, it'll be processed and enriched by Russia. Then it'll be shipped to France or for the processing, put in the fuel rods, and then returned back to Iran. And I think that Iran will do the deal in part because it's a good deal for Iran. I mean, the current regime in Iran is supportive of this kind of deal. It has a lot of big pluses. Most importantly for Iran is that they get a relaxation of sanctions against them. They get an opening up of trade opportunities, of banking opportunities, and they get a green light on promoting their nuclear enrichment or fuel rod enrichment program. And I think that that they do it with no big loss. I mean, if one wants to be cynical, one could say that in a year to 2 years' time, Iran, in fact, could be compiling, if they were really cynical about it, they could be compiling enough enriched uranium to do their own clandestine nuclear weapons enrichment. But in truth, there's not a lot of evidence that that's really the primary goal. So I know I heard Ali Larijani, the Iranian Speaker of the House's statement that this whole deal was a trick to steal Iran's fuel, and you know this was going to be a swindle. But I actually think that the Ahmadinejad crowd mingled in with the voices, the low level from Khomeini's crowd, are that this deal is a good deal, and I predict by Christmas or something it'll be a deal similar to this. There may be some watering down of the deal, but it'll be a deal that'll go through.
But I understand that that the only way the deal is going to work, in order to satisfy, for example, Israel, serious people in Israel are talking about a military strike. If you take all of the enriched uranium that they've got and reprocess it in one big batch, then it will definitely slow down any kind of clandestine nuclear program. But if you take it in piecemeal, they can keep replacing what they take. So it seems to me like the details have to be pretty firm in this.
I hate to say this, but you know, I've been on your show since at least 2006, and there are always rumors about imminent strikes by Israel on Iran's nuclear sites. That never did happen. I said it never would happen, and I don't think it ever will happen again. Israel, in fact, is being defanged in terms of its righteous indignation and even sanctions. Nobody's going to support an Israeli attack on Iran if any kind of deal goes through, and of course, Israel still needs a green light from the U.S., not so much to do the strike, but to handle the repercussions. So, no, there will be no strike by Israel on Iran. The deal of some kind will go through. It won't be all of Iran's uranium. That's not even on the table. And to be honest, if you're part of Netanyahu's crowd, he's going to keep pointing out that even sending 75, 85, 95% of LEU, of low-enriched uranium to Soviet Union, to Russia, doesn't guarantee that there isn't yet again a clandestine program to keep developing high-enriched weapons-grade uranium. By the way, there is a UN IAEA team in Iran right now as we speak. I think they arrived there today. And they're going to do a base examination, try to get back on sort of a flat level about where Iran's plans are and what they've got going. But there really is no absolute certain way to prevent Iran from developing weapons-grade fuel. But what you and I are concerned about is that any kind of deal like this will undermine Israel's support at all for any kind of threat of attack. It'll undermine the neocon and hawkish voices in America's the urgency about an attack. I think it will open up trade, and to a certain extent, it'll also support, sort of provide a bolstering for Iran's current leaders, who are having a lot of problem internally with that slow simmering green revolution, the so-called green revolution. That's the backers of Mousavi and the opponents of the last election, which is the green revolution hasn't died. It's just gone down to a low simmer, and there are still demonstrations in the universities. Like, those have escalated in the last few weeks, but they're small demonstrations and they're quickly put down. But still, you know, Iran is internally still has a festering problem that no one can really gauge the dimensions of. But I think this nuclear issue will go through, and I think that there, as I've been telling you for years, there'll be no attack from Israel and so forth.
But you're just telling us though that this deal will be good for Ahmadinejad and the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, who appear to be the powers now. They were behind the scenes, and now they stole the election, and now they seem to be fully in control. That's not good news for the reformists.
It's not good news for the reformists. The revolution, I agree with you. I think that the green revolution, quote-unquote, is just slowly simmering, and I think that this nuclear deal, in fact, will hurt them, not help them. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that the nuclear resolution, the nuclear deal that's going to go through, that started in Vienna and will finish up in Geneva later on this month, at the end of this month, I think that deal is a good deal for Iran's current leaders and will, in fact, make them more secure. That's on one level. And on the other level, they do have to deal with a lot of prominent clerical figures and opposition leaders who refuse to be silenced. You've got, Mehdi Karoubi, who is out of jail, but is potentially going to be jailed, and he is won't shut up. He keeps criticizing the same revolutionary government that he helped bring about.
And of course, he has real credentials, having been the closest cleric to Ayatollah Khomeini. And
jailed. I mean, he was jailed 9-10 times by the Shah. He spent years in prison. There's no one more credible and more legitimate than Karoubi. Mm-hmm. And he is now being denounced by the current administration. I mean, what's going to happen with this opposition movement is anyone's guess.
Well, what about these rumors that the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, is dead?
Oh, those are silly rumors. Silly rumors. That's Michael Ledeen propaganda. Michael Ledeen posted on one of his blogs, I guess it was 10 days ago or something, or 2 weeks ago, he posted on a blog that he had excellent sources, quote-unquote, that Khamenei had collapsed. And Michael Ledeen, of course, is the same guy that told us about yellow cake uranium for Iraq, and he told us about, he told us 2 years ago that Khamenei was dying or was ill and dying. So, no, those are all baseless rumors. If Khamenei has appeared on television since then, he met with Senegal's president on October 18th. I mean, he is not. I mean, he's 70 years old. He's not the most healthy 70-year-old you're ever going to meet, but he's not dead and he's not dying. Mm-hmm. Any more than we're all dying. So no, those are silly rumors, and they're promoted by neocons, and they keep you know, go down to Michael Ledeen's blog and see if he ever talks about Khamenei.
I think I'll spare myself there.
Yeah, there we go. I agree with you. no, but we don't. There are no. Those are false rumors.
Okay, but there's no question though that the supreme leader's son is the key player, is he not? He's very close to Ahmadinejad, and he appears to be the kind of connection between the religious leadership and the IRGC, the Iranian Revolution Guard Corps.
Yes, I agree that he seems to be the anointed one. We will see what happens. I mean, if there is, when I should say, Khamenei does fail and does want to pass the baton or whatever, his son is absolutely being set up for that kind of key role, but a lot can happen. Quite frankly, Ian, a lot could happen in the next 24 to 36 months in Iran. And it's not a an obvious given that anyone that is really, really close to Khamenei or Ahmadinejad will be the next winners in this round. I mean, we still haven't heard the other shoe drop from people like Rafsanjani, who has been laying low the last few months. But still, you know, we've got Mousavi and Rafsanjani, who have quite large power bases, that have a lot to say about what's going to happen next. So I wouldn't take it as a given that Khamenei can appoint his own successor and then suddenly have this be a given.
Well, it's pretty obvious, particularly from the recent uprisings against the theft of the elections, that the frustration was clearly simmering for a long time amongst the educated and the youth and the women, I guess, the main sort of constituency for the reform movement. And it was just sort of adding too much insult to injury to have that election stolen in that kind of flagrant and clumsy way, since already the democracy was sort of rigged at any rate. And I just get the feeling that those feelings are not going to go away, that there's a seething disdain for this government, but I just don't know how that can be mobilized in any way, particularly if the Western countries and their leaders are going to sell out the people in a sense by making this very unpopular and very, quite radical government give it more credibility and get it to the point where if they get rid of sanctions, then they'll be often humming, won't they?
You and I agree on what's happening. I would like to see a lifting of sanctions. I don't think sanctions have worked to undermine the current administration. Haven't done anything to hinder Iran's development, either economically or let's say regionally, militarily, and so forth. So I don't think the sanctions are an effective way of achieving what the U.S. wants or even what reformers want in Iran. I know that there's a faction of Iranians, especially in Southern California, that would like to see the U.S. sort of either attack Iran or at least cut off Iran or increase sanctions and so forth. And there are members of various groups in Washington who would like to see the same thing. I really do believe, I support the notion that that increased exposure, openness towards Iran, that Obama's notion that he would, in fact, negotiate with the current administration, and that openness and negotiation and diplomacy are the way to improve relations, and ultimately, I think, to even encourage the reform elements within the Iranian government, I think those are the right way to go. I don't believe you ever win by saying, this is a nasty regime, we won't deal with them, we'll shut them down because dealing with them will legitimize them. I think that hasn't proven effective through the last, the last 35 years, and won't prove effective in the next period of time to come. I do believe that the way to do it is to open negotiations, be more open with them, increase trade, actually increase movement of Iranians in and out of the country, and so forth. So I think those are the ways to go.
Well, we know that name-calling and the axis of evil and what went under George W. Bush have been completely counterproductive, not the least of which was by taking out Saddam Hussein, and they then got made Iran much more powerful and influential in that neighborhood.
Right, absolutely. Everything, every policy of the Bush administration enhanced Iran's influence, power, and also defiance in the region itself. I think Iran has right now, one of the reasons Iran can sort of thumb its nose at almost anything that comes out of Washington is because they do have regionally an enormously powerful position.
And how much are they screwing with the United States in Afghanistan? Because there are reports of Iranian weaponry slipping in, and what would the motive be there? You know,
Iran has a very strong motive in seeing stability come to Afghanistan. They don't want to see ongoing battles there. They have in fact done this weird dance where they cooperate with the U.S. and at times oppose the U.S. and U.S. efforts in Afghanistan. The U.S. does not like the Taliban. They historically have not gotten along well with the Taliban. They really don't like elements of the most radical Taliban in Pakistan. This has been a back and forth with them in terms of who they can support and how much military aid they give to various warlords and or chieftains or regional leaders in northern and western Afghanistan. But Iran is absolutely a player in Afghanistan and a very significant player in Iraq. And I think efforts in the future to promote peace and development and stability in those areas all have to go through Tehran in part, and that Tehran is there whether we like them or not. And I think it behooves the current U.S. administration, and I think Obama does know this and listens to experts who tell him that one of the positive byproducts of a rapprochement of some kind or a grand bargain of some kind is that we do get a player who is much more clearly and transparently cooperating with the ongoing issues in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, so the logic then of them supplying more sophisticated IEDs that blow up American armored vehicles and kill American soldiers and NATO soldiers.
Yeah, I don't believe that rumor, by the way. I don't believe that rumor. I didn't believe any of the U.S. rumors about government-sanctioned radical increase in technology in Iraq either.
Right.
I think those rumors went away as well, by the way, even while anti-Iranian rhetoric was escalating. I don't believe the Tehran government had a vested interest in seeing that happen.
But on the other hand, they're accusing the United States of arming and equipping the rebels in Balochistan in the Pakistan border there, who are responsible for killing a bunch of IRGC.
Right, with the Jundullah. You're speaking of the Jundullah attacks in Peshin. Well, the Jundullah, actually, I mean, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. Am I willing to consider seriously the notion that the CIA or U.S., let's say, U.S. efforts to foment unrest in provincial areas might be a reality? Absolutely, I believe that.
Well, they were under the Bush administration.
The Bush administration bragged about it, right?
I know, but
I believe those programs don't just die because Barack Obama takes office. I believe that many of those programs were promoted. And even if there is no evidence right now that Jundullah is receiving U.S. money, the fact is, as they move, they're based in Pakistan, they move across that border freely. I don't believe that the U.S., Great Britain, or any of the other players that Lada Jani sort of accused of being involved in that recent attack, which was very, very bloody, killed easily over 50 people, and including senior Revolutionary Guard members. I think that I think Jundullah is probably on their own now, but they were the recipients of U.S. aid at one point in the last decade, and that I think that the Iranian government has a right to be paranoid. But that statement about they have evidence, they haven't produced any evidence, they won't produce any real evidence, and I don't think that's going to be an impediment to the furthering of the nuclear issue, the nuclear deal it is as well either. You can always expect a statement by someone in the Iranian government that they have evidence that all the protesters were U.S. agents or foreign agents, and that every attack on Iran is directly tied into some foreign player meddling with Iranian affairs. But some of these incidences have ties to the U.S.'s funding for opposition. Most of them don't, and the evidence produced by the Iranian government is almost always inconsequential.
Well, I'm going to check in with you, Jahan, in a little while to see, since you've put your stuck your neck out there and made these predictions, that this
once again, I've made firm statements about what's going to happen.
This nuclear deal will go through, and Ahmadinejad's going to be more in the saddle than ever, which, of course, to a lot of people is a hideous thought, but
it is.
That's realpolitik, I guess.
I agree with you, Ian. Let's see what happens. Check with me again in a few months, okay?
Okay. Thanks a lot.
A real pleasure being with you again. Take care.
You too. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Jahan Salehi, who was born in Iran, raised and educated in the United States. He was formerly the managing director of the European operations for the Los Angeles Times Syndicate, and he's currently the international director of Agence Global, an international media agency with correspondent specialists and analysts covering all regions of the world, including Iran. And he's suggesting that the nuclear deal to ship Iran's enriched uranium to Russia will indeed go ahead. So we'll check in later and see whether that happens later in the year. And now we're going to look into California's state of dysfunction. We're joined by Dan Walters, who's a political columnist for the Sacramento Bee, covering the state capital since 1975. He's the co-author of a new book entitled The Third House, Lobbyists, Money, and Power in Sacramento. Dan, thank you so much for joining us. And just recently, chief jurist in the state, the Chief Justice Ronald George, gave a speech where he talked about California's state of dysfunction, the perils of direct democracy, the California experience, which has gotten a lot of attention. Now, what kind of reaction has happened with the political pros in the Capitol there? Broadside from the Chief Justice, has it affected them anyway, or how did they react?
Well, there wasn't much of a reaction. I think that Ron George was telling people in the Capitol something they already knew,
mm-hmm.
and, something I've been writing about for about 20 years or so, that there is a confluence of forces, demographic, economic, cultural, and political forces. No, there are no villains in this piece, but that these various trends have kind of coincided to create consequences that no one ever foresaw, and the chief consequence being, in my view anyway, that California has essentially rendered itself ungovernable. And I think it's now being widely recognized. I took a lot of grief over the thing over the years of writing about that sort of thing and suggesting such a terrible thing. But in fact, it's now become orthodoxy. It's become kind of conventional wisdom in political and academic circles, not because necessarily something that Ron George said or what I wrote, but the budget crisis, the never-ending budget crisis, has finally driven home the point, I think, that when it comes to making policy for 38 million Californians, the structure of government, the political government we have in California, is such that you can't get there from here. You can't get it. You can't pass a budget that's balanced. You can't pass a water program that actually produces water. You can't do anything. We are absolutely locked into a structure of ungovernability, and it affects us all. It means that we have a government that doesn't work, and doesn't do what government is supposed to do, which is to deal with our common problems and do so in a way that denotes progress of some kind. I mean, you know, you can just tick it off: the transportation crisis, the education crisis, the water crisis, the budget crisis. There's no relief on any of these things. We have a whole structure of unresolved issues, and they stay unresolved year after year after year after year, and nobody seems to be able to crack the nut. And it's my belief that the reason they can't crack the nut is not dependent on who the governor is or what party's in power, but really it's built into the structure. In fact, an interesting thing happened. The legislature actually had a hearing on this issue the other day, and Bill Lockyer reminded them, the state treasurer, Bill Lockyer, reminded them of something that I've written about several times, which is that the checks and balances that we put into the government, that we adopted when we became a state, have become such that we cannot make decisions. No matter which way you go, somebody can block you. And so we have a situation in which I call it hyper-democracy, in which we basically give everyone a veto power. Well, if you have everyone a veto power, or every significant interest and stakeholder group a veto power on every issue, then you can never get there, because you cannot resolve all the differences. At some point, you have to say, no, this is what we're going to do, even though you, whatever you are, don't like it. And yet we have a system in which if you don't like it, you can go out and stop anything from happening. And that's what happened. That's exactly what we have.
So, Dan Wallace, when you say the state's ungovernable, does that let the politicians off the hook? If you're saying that it's just structural and has nothing to do with the quality of the people in government, the politicians, then where's the hope?
Well, the hope is that you change that you recognize that it is a structural, systemic problem of governing a state as complex and as large as California. And you go fix it. You go do something. You change the structure. You make it more responsive. You make it more accountable than what we have. Now, we have a wonderful system for passing the buck in California. We don't have a system for holding people accountable for what they do. No, I don't let politicians off the hook. They have perpetuated this and in many respects have made it worse over time by what they have chosen to do. But I also recognize that it's something that predates Arnold Schwarzenegger, it predates the current legislature, it predates term limits, it predates all of these things that some people cite as being impediments to governance, that it is a structural impediment. And I've watched it happen. I mean, I've been in the Capitol 35 years, and I have literally watched the Capitol move from being a functioning entity capable of making policy decisions with some degree of intelligence and foresight into something that cannot make any kind of policy decisions with any kind of degree of functionally and foresight. And I've watched it happen, and I've seen the impediments come towards decision-making one by one by one. Not all of them are political impediments. Many of them are built into what we are as a state. We are a very complex state. People don't really appreciate just how diverse and complex California is. And, of course, we have diversity and complexity, economic complexity, social complexity, cultural complexity, geographic complexity. You not only spawn many issues that are themselves complex, but you also have the conditions that make resolving those problems virtually impossible. I mean, it is truly a case of unintended consequences. We didn't set out to have an unworkable government. It's something that evolved. It's like having a disease, and it progresses, and it progresses and progresses. And you might even be aware that you have this malady until suddenly all of these symptoms come crashing down on you, and you find out, my God, I'm sick. I'm really sick.
But Dan Wallace, in this case, is the patient going to die, or is the patient going to be cured? I mean, if you when you said you've been there 30 years in the Capitol, you've seen it when you first went there. California was one of the leading states in the union, and not to mention the world, ahead in education and innovation, etc. And now it's at the bottom, and its credit rating
is a laughing stock. I mean, let's we are now becoming national and even international laughingstock. I mean, newspapers in England and other countries send reporters to California and say, what's going on? There was an article in the Guardian newspaper in England one time. The headline on it was, will California be the first failed state? I mean, we have become a laughingstock on our inability to govern ourselves effectively.
Mm.
And the question is, are we going to do something about it? Well, as we know, there are two efforts to try to do something about it, one by a group called California Forward, Bob Hertzberg, former Speaker of the Assembly, and, by the way, a man being prominently mentioned as a potential appointed lieutenant governor is part of the California Forward group, which has a reform agenda that they're trying to do. It's kind of an incremental agenda. It's a one-step-at-a-time agenda. And then there's another group called the Bay Area Council. It's a group of corporate CEOs from the San Francisco Bay Area promoting the idea of a constitutional convention that would examine California's structure of government from top to bottom and say, what do we need to do to make it work?
And when you try and rewrite a constitution, when you open up a constitutional convention, how can you limit the all of the special interests who want to put in a constitutional amendment to ban abortion, gay marriage, you name it?
You don't know whether you can or not. And then one of the things that the Bay Area Council is trying to do as they draft their initiative that would allow voters to call a constitutional convention is to specify in the initiative, in the measure that would go before voters presumably next year, specify what that constitutional convention can and cannot do. What they're trying to do is keep it from going into all sorts of hot-button social issues and simply dwell to concentrate on the structure of governance to create a better decision making, not make decisions about what policies ought to be, but to create a better system for making those decisions. And they're having a tough time doing it. I mean, it's very difficult because they get sniped at the left and the right. The left fears that something will happen. The right fears that something will happen. So there's a lot of pressure on what this constitutional convention ought to do if, in fact, it takes place. It's not an easy thing to do, and what you imply is very, very possible, which is that the same conflicts and forces that make us ungovernable could also prevent us from making ourselves governable. In other words, could tie up that sort of any kind of reform effort could tie that up, because if people who don't like certain aspects of the reform might just kill the whole thing. So, yes, there's a very great danger of that. In fact, you have to say realistically that probably the chances of actually creating a more responsive and accountable structure of government in California probably has a less than 50-50 chance of happening. I wish I could say it was better, but it's probably less than 50-50. Given all the pitfalls along the way, doing so will be extremely difficult. But then what is the alternative to trying? The alternative is to continue down the path we are towards what I have called a tribal society, in which California devolves into a collection of mutually hostile tribes defined by ethnicity, by income, by geography, by whatever. And then politics simply devolves further into the way by which these tribes conduct tribal warfare rather than what it should be, which is the way to deal with common issues and problems.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute, Dan Walters, is again, how much of the is this about the politicians? Because you recall that Ken Lay and Enron were able to sell deregulation to these same politicians up there, who they all drank the Kool-Aid, and then the state of California got ripped off to the tune of about $30 billion by...
Well, that's a little revisionist history, by the way. That's not exactly what happened, but
yeah,
I understand your point.
Well, and then the governor, who at the time was the victim, as this whole state was, he ended up twisting in the wind, and then they had a special recall election to bring in another guy who was going to ride in on a white horse. I mean, in other words, at what point are we victims of bad or gullible politicians, particularly in that brief revisionist history there?
Maybe we should be looking at, what is it about the political system that gives us gullible politicians? Why aren't they capable of making the kinds of long-range decisions, effective decisions that they clearly were once capable of doing for California a couple of generations ago. It's not that we've suddenly elected evil people. What we've done is we elect people who are crippled by the system, by the structure of government that we have, and are not held accountable for the decisions that they make or don't make.
Well, I thank you.
They are able to pass that buck.
I thank you again for joining us. I'd like to thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Janie Cooley, the assistant producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, and Anthony Castillo, the assistant producer, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.